Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 188 for October 26th, 2011, Web 2 Pi. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring Wi-Fi connectivity with available sync and MyFord Touch. Now your car can be a Wi-Fi hotspot. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the big players, the little players, the, well, not necessarily size little, but, you know, projects that might you might not have heard of because they don't have quite a distribution that we have. But I've got a lot of great guests coming up, but really, the only way to make this thing work is that we bring on a co-host. Co-host this week is none other than Dan Lynch. Dan Lynch, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be back.
Very good, very good. And in my absence, in my three-week absence, while I was busy off gallivanting in Europe, you took the co-host slot. At least, was it once or twice? I forget now.
I hosted once, and I co-hosted with Aaron once as well.
Wow! So you've taken both seats, both the big seat and the seat on the other side. Wow! What was it like having the big seat?
It was good. You've got some good cushions on that big seat, I've got to say. It's very comfortable.
Well, I have a large ass to sit in it, so that's why. And I just want to give a quick shout out. I'm back at my favorite guys, Media Temple, who provide not only this mug, but also the giant microphone to my left. And I appreciate them letting me take the time out of work to go off and do this. Really what the show is about, not about you and me, it's about the guests that we have on the show. This week, very interesting guest. We have, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Massimo Di Piero, who is the associate professor at the School of Computing at DePaul University in Chicago. He has a framework that he created from scratch called Web2Py. It's a Python-based web framework that, as I was reading through documentation for it, looks similar to Rails in a lot of ways, and that it has a lot of things done by convention rather than by explicit design. I appreciate that when we can bring a framework up and make it deliver web pages really quick. But, you know, again, it's yet another web framework, so we're going to have to really ask him, you know, why this one instead of one of the other 17 that I've had on this show, because there seems to be, you know, it seems to be like a rite of passage to create a web framework and create a templating language and create a database access set of rules and things like that. So we'll see how this one actually distinguishes from all other web frameworks. But any comments on that, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things I love. It's Python and web frameworks. So let's do it.
Oh, Python. Yeah, that's the downside of this. It's Python. I'm going to bite my lip the entire time about this. I'm pretty sure. I'll try not to make any jokes about indenting the entire time, but you never know. It's kind of crazy that way. Well, great. But before we bring our guest on, I have a sponsor. I appreciate it when Floss Weekly helps get paid for. We pay the bills by having sponsors. And we do have a sponsor. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford. One of the latest technologies from Ford's sync with My Ford Touch is Wi-Fi connectivity. This feature can turn your car into a Wi-Fi hotspot, giving you and your passengers internet access for up to 5 devices at once. Here's how it works. Establish an internet connection to the Wi-Fi hotspot by plugging in a portable wireless access card from one of the wireless carriers into a USB port located in the center armrest console or the glove compartment or under the radio, depending on the model. Or if you have a BlackBerry, you can connect to the hotspot wirelessly via Bluetooth. Next, you connect up to 5 Wi-Fi-enabled devices to the hotspot using a secure password, and then you're in. Now, you or your passengers can access music, browse the internet, download apps, or play games via Wi-Fi. Hopefully not while you're driving. Please don't do it while you're driving. They can connect their laptops, tablet, mobile phones, or other internet devices to the hotspot, up to 5 devices at once, all without an additional subscription or expense. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch features Wi-Fi connectivity and is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology. Change page. There we go. I guess that's it. So we thank them for sponsoring Floss Weekly and the Twit Network. And now on to our guest. Massimo, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Well, very good. Very good. And where are you speaking to us from?
Right now, I'm at my office at DePaul University.
What university?
DePaul University. It's in Chicago.
Oh, Chicago. Okay, good. So not too many time zones away. I was sort of worried that we were speaking to you someplace in the Europe or whatever, but I guess not. So great.
No,
cool.
No. I've been living in the U.S. for 12 years now.
Oh, very good. Very good. Okay. So at the opening of the show, I sort of talked a bit about Web2Py, and I obviously it's yet another web framework, but let's go back to the 30,000 foot level and sort of give you the quick rundown of the basics of Web2Py. What's it about?
Well, Web2Py is a web framework, very much like other web frameworks that people know about, like Ruby on Rails or Django or others. Probably the main difference is we try to focus on making very easy to deploy applications, more than just developing the applications. So it has a web-based integrated development environment that allow you to easily deploy an application remotely or manage multiple applications under the same Web2Py instance.
Okay, so so not about actually authoring the application. You'd still be using some sort of text editor for that, right?
You have two choices. You can use a regular shell with your own text editor, but you can also edit the application online through the web-based IDE that comes with it. So for power users usually don't do that, but it may be convenient. Sometimes you are on vacation and you need to fix something in your application and you have a computer which is not your own computer and you can only access a browser. It's convenient to be able to edit everything.
Wow. Okay. So that already makes it pretty distinguished from some of the other web frameworks we've covered on the show, except maybe Seaside. So how did this come about? What's the beginning of Web2Py, and how did you get involved? Presuming you're the original author, so just go back to history for a second.
Well, what happened? It was about 2007, and I had been teaching a course here at the university on web development with Python. And at the time, I was using Django, and Django was version 0.96, and I knew they were going to release the next version. I wanted something that was a little easier for the students, not so much from the point of view of programming, but more from the point of view of deployment. For example, a lot of students are not aware that there is such a thing like a shell. They're not confident with shell commands. So getting to teach how to use a web framework when you have to start by teaching how to use a shell and shell commands and editors and things like that just takes a lot of override for me. So I wanted to use something that was a little bit easier to start with, and also something that I would really understand all the nuts and bolts. And I looked at various alternatives, and all of the frameworks at the time were a little bit changing because Django was about to release one, and I really did not know what the changes were going to be. Turbo Gears were version 1 and was going to go to version 2, but I didn't know for sure about the date. So I decided, why don't I start building something really simple that I can go over the source code with my students and they can deploy at the click of a button so they get everything they need just by unzipping a file. So this was how it started. And to my surprise, a lot of people started using it seriously and gave me a lot of advice of to make it better, basically. And people contributed, and I think it's thanks to the users that Web2Py is as popular as it is today and is as good as it is today, because people have really contributed with a lot of patches and improvements.
So like a lot of interesting projects, it started as a training vehicle then, so you could use it in your classrooms. Now, did you start with any sort of existing framework? I mean, did you base it on Django, or is this really sort of built from the bottom up?
No, the idea was to have something that was simple enough I could actually code all of it in class. So I did not use any third-party tool. It was completely written from scratch. The only thing I assumed was Python version 2.5 at the time, and the libraries that come with version 2.5. So the first thing I wrote was basically the database abstraction layer, then I wrote the template language, and then I wrote the dispatcher, and other modules came later. What happened over time is that as more people got involved, some of these core modules were completely rewritten. Like last year, the template language and database abstraction layer, which comprise almost 50% of Web2Py now, they were completely rewritten. We did it keeping backward compatibility, so we never broke backward compatibility since 2007, But over time, it became different than what originally was designed for. So I still use it in classes, and I still build a mini Web2Py from scratch in my classes. But I can no longer go over the source code the way I used to.
So that's a really ambitious project. Looking back on it, do you have a sense of how much code you'd have to write to get a working system?
Probably to get a working system didn't take too much code, less than 10,000 lines.
Okay.
Python is a very expressive language and already comes with libraries to be able to handle cookies, for example, and building sessions on top of cookies is relatively easy. Originally, we used one third-party library, actually, that was the Cherry Pie web server. But then one of our users created the Rocket web server, which we now include in Web2Py. So that's kind of our own web server. It supports SSL. It's really fast. And we learned a lot from other frameworks. So it was a little different than other frameworks, but also we had the luxury to be able to study the other ones. And Web2Py would not have been possible if I had not used before Ruby on Rails and Django, from which I really have learned a lot, and I really owe them a lot.
Mm. So, Massimo, I'm curious, what made you, at the risk of upsetting Randall here, what made you choose Python for this? Was it just that you were already, as you say, familiar with Python, or was that really where it came from?
Well, I learned Python about 9 years ago. That's when I started using it. And when I started Web2Py, I knew Python well. It was not my primary language. My primary language has always been C++. Before building Web2Py, I was mostly doing completely different things. So I was using C++ for almost everything. So I learned Python, and I really started to love Python. And it was really, I found it to be a good language for teaching. So here at the university, I have introduced Python in a number of courses. We now have Python in our introductory computer science courses, and I use it even in very advanced math courses. I use the NumPy and SciPy libraries. So when it came to build a framework, I thought it was a natural choice for me.
Hmm. And on a very slight tangent here, you've actually recently, fairly recently, been elected to the Python Software Foundation. So you've gone from being a Python novice to being right at the kind of the heart of it, if you like. Is that fair?
It is fair. It was a big surprise for me. And I have had friends who suggested my name to the Python Software Foundation. I was really honored to be a member. I still am trying to figure out exactly what my responsibilities are. And I'm really looking forward to be a more active contributor.
Mm, excellent. So you mentioned briefly before about the fact that you haven't broken backwards compatibility since 2007, or you've never, in fact, broken backwards compatibility, which is a promise that you make in your documentation and so on. And I was curious to know, since we're talking about Python and so on, Python 3 is kind of coming down the line now, and that actually breaks backwards compatibility with Python 2. So will you be able to adopt Python 3, or will that affect your promise to, you know, never break backwards compatibility?
This is a good point and comes up a lot. Let me say there is one caveat to backward compatibility. If we have any security issue that requires breaking backward compatibility, we address the security issue. So that's a priority. Yeah. Security comes first. So this has happened once. There was one, now you have to add one line to very old applications to make sure that there is a security patch in place. About Python 3, well, we are going to stick with backward compatibility, which means Web2Py will be only running on Python 2.5, 2.4, 2.6, and 2.7. But that does not mean that we're not going to try port it to 3. Actually, there is a fork already done that runs on Python 3, and it's available on GitHub. It was made by a user, Mariano Rengar. So we have Web2Py running on 3. What we're going to do is we're not going to market Web2Py as something for Python 3. We are probably going to rename it as a different product. And the moment we do that, we're going also to readdress other issues. So the moment we break backward compatibility, we will not just do it to move from 2 to 3. We'll also redesign some parts that require breaking our own API.
Hmm. Okay, you've actually preempted one of my other questions I was going to ask, which is what happens when you get a conflict between security, which I know is very important to you, and backwards compatibility, because sometimes things change and you need to move with the times just for security's sake. So you're saying that the security needs always override the backwards compatibility?
Yes. Mm. We only had one issue. That, basically, the way WebKit was designed, like many other web frameworks, we have a model view controller design. So you create the controller, and then the data that is returned by the controller gets rendered by a view. And one place where WebKit was different than other frameworks is that even if you don't have a view, we'll try to render the data for you somehow. And there's a collection of generic views, and we'll try to pick one that matches your data. So, for example, if you request a page in .html, we'll render it in HTML. If you request in .json, we'll try to render your data in JSON, and so on. And it occurred to people that sometimes your controller may return something that you don't want to expose in the view. That's not exactly how it should be done. You should program in such a way that when you return data, you want it to be exposed. But sometimes people forget. So we decided that the generic view would not be completely automated. You have to say that you want them. So this was this was a change that partially broke backward compatibility. You did not have to recode anything, but you had to set the flag.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, so you wouldn't automatically get this this main view that you're talking about. Now that brings us on to something that I was talking to some friends today, in fact, about Web2Py when we were talking about this interview coming up, and they were saying, I don't know how true this is, but they were saying there's been a bit of, I don't know if controversy is the right word, in the Python community over the fact that Web2Py tries to make certain decisions, doesn't try to make certain decisions, but it kind of does a lot more for the user, as you say, and it's part of your original design goals that you don't just get a terminal and have to start from there. Is it fair that there has been some conflicting views within the Python world about what approach should be taken, and how has that affected the project?
I think it is fair to say that there are different points of view, and I don't know if I would call it a controversy, but there is one philosophy in the Python world, which is that explicit is better than implicit. And on purpose, we do not follow that. We believe that we want to attract new users, not from inside the Python community, but from outside the Python community. And explicit is better than implicit means that you have to declare everything in very pedantic details sometimes. And if you're not already a good Python programmer, you know, that results in verbose code can be difficult to do. So our approach is very much the Rails approach, that everything should have a default. And if you don't like the default, you go and change it. So a Python user, when an experienced Python user, when he looks at a Web2Py program, he will find some variables or some objects existing in the Web2Py environment that were not explicitly imported. They're not magic. I mean, they're just well-documented in the book. They're just imported for you as by default. And then if you don't like their behavior, you go and change them. So okay, it was so this a design choice that we made. And that's what makes Web2Py very different from the other Python frameworks.
What this really reminds me of is Rails. And I think actually some of the documentation you mentioned that this was sort of modeled somewhat on Rails, where by convention, everything just sort of falls into place. So I'm a little bit concerned about that, because I know one of the complaints I've heard about Rails, which I guess is sort of what the Python community is saying about Web2Py, is that if you have sort of a core application that sort of fits the model that you've established in terms of the convention, it's great. I mean, you can get a blog up in 5 minutes and all those wonderful demos that we see of these kinds of frameworks. But whenever you want to go sort of beyond that, like you want to get to something that's more complex interactions, there really isn't enough escape valves to be able to kind of get down back into the low level without fighting it every step tooth and nail. Now, does Web2Py have that problem similarly?
I don't think it does. I think it's every object. Basically, the workflow is very much the workflow of other Python frameworks like Django. Just that in the environment in which we code, we have some objects that are predefined and have a default behavior. you can replace those objects, you can change the behavior of those objects, and it does not really forces you to a certain way. You can do things in a different way if you like. There are two exceptions to this. One is security. We don't let the user mess up with any part of the code that has to do with security. Like, you don't really choose how your sessions are handled. You don't choose how your session cookies are handled. And we do this on purpose. We think that it's very difficult to get that right. And we had a number of people work on that to make sure we got it right. And a naive developer should not be able to change that.
I also noticed in terms of security, you automatically escape everything gets inserted unless you go to extreme pains of putting XML parens around it or something like that. And I appreciate that to avoid any kind of cross-site scripting attacks. Is that another version of your security model?
That's it, yes. Actually, that XML tag comes from the idea of using the XML tag to declare that a certain variable should not be escaped. We did not invent that. We actually took the syntax from the KIT template language, which was used by TurboGears 1.
So what's the interaction? If I wanted to sit down and start with Web2Py, what would I have to download or get on my system, and then what am I looking at when I'm first firing it up? What's the interaction there?
Well, you have two options. The first thing, you need to decide whether you want to run the source version or the executable. We ship executables for Windows and Mac. But whatever you do, you just download a zip file, you unzip it, and you either click on the .py file if you have the source, or you click on the .exe file if you have the executable. And you don't need to install it. There is no concept of installing Web2Py. You just unzip it and start it. What it does, it prompts you for a one-time administrator password. And you type in, you choose that password, server side. And then it starts the web server for you. And it opens the browser for you at a fixed location. And from that moment on, you interact with Web2Py through the browser. One Web2Py instance can have multiple applications running under it, and each application can have its own database and its own database management interface. They can share data, they can share databases if they want to. So every after you install it, after the browser starts for you, through the browser you have the option to choose, you have a number of links in this page that you're looking at, and different links point you to the different applications that are running under Web2Py. By default, you get three. You get an application, which is the administrative interface. And by that, I mean the web-based integrated development environment. So once you click on that button, you go into the administrative interface. You see a list of all the applications installed. You have buttons to install applications from remote websites. You have buttons to create new applications. You have buttons to check the status of an application, like, is it running? And what data is it storing, and so on. And you can browse the files that comprise an application, and they are organized. They are organized by type. So Web2Py stores no metadata. Every application under the Web2Py instance is its own directory structure. And the directory structure is replicated into the website that basically designs the administrative interface. So you have model files, you have controller files, you have views files, and you navigate them through the web interface. You can edit the files, and also you can see what these files do. So let's say you have a web application with a number of pages. Each page corresponds to a function defined in a certain file. So you can edit the file and edit the functions, but also Web2Py is going to introspect the file and is going to list the names of all the pages that found that you have defined. So you can really manage your application. You can try it the web interface.
Wow, that sounds impressive. I just came back to something you mentioned earlier. You said you manage the session data for the user. Now, does this presume that you're running your own Python web server so that you have essentially one main process with threads rather than having separate launch things like you would under Apache?
Web2Py comes with its own web server, which is a really fast SSL-enabled web server. Mm-hmm. And this one is multi-threaded web server. Mm-hmm. Most people use it, that way. But if you're in a production environment and you have something like Apache or LightDB or, you know, Cherokee, there are many web servers out there. WebPy works with all of them because WebPy talks to the web server using either the WSGI protocol or the FCGI protocol and also other protocols, but these are the most common ones which cover many many web servers. So WebPy comes with a bunch of adapters for many different web servers and different protocols. So if you have Apache, you just configure Apache to point to WebPy. It will go around the WebPy built-in web server. We also provide a file called anyserver.py that basically supports all kind of other Python servers like GNUnicorn or I don't even know how to pronounce it, may sound names, but there are many. We support probably 15 different web servers.
Wow. Now, so that means that the session data never has to be serialized then because you're really just working within a single process.
Well, the way we handle sessions is the only choice users can make is whether the session data should be stored on the file system or should be stored in the database. So what WebPy does is every time you visit the page for a page within an application for the first time, it issues a one-time session ID, which is a UUID, and that gets stored in a cookie. So only this cookie gets transferred back and forth. It does not matter which web server you use.
Okay, so you can serialize session data. Good. That would be helpful for scaling. Speaking of scaling,
It's not serialized through... it's not stored client-side.
No, I understand that. That's but I mean, it's serialized server-side. But it's being stored in a database,
right? It's
serialized
server-side, yes. It okay.
So what's... speaking of scaling, so what's... Is there a large installation of this? Is this something that I could use for, say, a high-traffic website?
My experience is the bottleneck is always access in database. Mm-hmm. There is nothing specifically into WebPy which is can be considered the bottleneck. So the problem is the database is not going to scale any worse or any better than any other database-driven web framework.
Okay, that's a fair answer. So you could cluster this, actually, then, and actually have a bunch of them behind a load balancer and be able to generate
absolutely.
Something.
Oh, I know people who do that.
Okay, so are there large installations of Web2Py that we might have stumbled across on the public net?
In my experience, most of the people who use Web2Py use it for some kind of intranets.
Okay.
And I know some companies who do. I'm sure I'm allowed to say the names of those companies. And I'm not even sure how large are those installations they have. But I know some of them are relatively large companies. In terms of public websites, we have a page, web2py.com/powered-by, where we list the users that we know, the public users that we know. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you what the largest installation is. I know of installations that have probably of the order of... like 1,000 users or 10,000 users, but I don't know for a fact. I mean, I don't know for sure. I don't really keep track of this kind of information.
So what's the sense, what's the size of your user community in the sense of people who are actively contributing and patching the source code?
I have very active users, I would say about 100 people.
Okay.
We have a core of about 20 who are really, really active, meaning that we keep in contact almost every day. But if I consider all the people who contribute, for example, once a month, I would say about 100 people.
And how do you manage the coordination for that? Is there some sort of like, are you like the executive chef and no ingredients go in unless you approve it? Or how does this work?
That's something that has been changing over time and probably will continue to change as we move to different version control systems. The way it works right now is people email me patches and I look at them, I decide, I apply, and then I commit. Mm-hmm. So far, I usually handle this aspect. We're going to move to GitHub soon, so probably this process will change and will become more flexible.
Oh, very good, very good. So you'll have
I have asked a number of contributors if they wanted to work in a different way. Instead of mail me patches like... use a more automated way. And so far, most of the people were actually happy with this process because it's relatively easy. And also, I like to review all the patches on my machine, which makes it easy. Mm.
Now, what's the situation that had you, I think you've said it earlier, but I'm now just blanking on it. But so what triggered you to need a web framework that you were using? Was it for a class you were teaching, or are you teaching computer science? Are you teaching, I think you're doing more like numeric calculations, right?
Well, I teach a lot of different things. I think I taught 13 different subjects here at the university. So
wow.
It really changes. At the time I started the WebPy project, I had basically two different needs. One was I was actually teaching a class on web frameworks. Mm. And my goal was to explain what web frameworks are, what are the basic components of all the frameworks. So how do they handle sessions, cookies, caching, database abstraction layers, object directional mappers. And it's very difficult to just point to existing frameworks without looking at the source code. And looking at the source code of something I did not write was difficult for me to do. So I decided I wanted something simple that I could actually write code in class. Not all of it, but the core parts. I could type in class from scratch. And students would understand what were pieces of code were doing. And then I could go over multiple frameworks out there and explain how the syntax may be different, but they may still handle a session, a cookie, a cache, and so on. And they understand the workflow. And that was one of the reasons for me to do it. The second is that I really needed to develop a number of websites for my own research, mm-hmm. mainly stuff related to physics, to handle some physics data. And I knew how I wanted to be able to code. I knew which parts were really taking my time. I know, for example, that the process of deploying a website and copying from one place to another, or instruct a colleague on how to set up their own system. For me, this was really time-consuming, so I was trying to solve this problem.
Hmm. And so you've used this both... I'm just curious about this. And so you built this sort of to be small and understandable. Now, has it kind of grown away from that, where it's about as big as all the other web frameworks again, or is there still a small, easy part when you're walking through the source code to be able to teach people?
There are some parts that they're still easy, in the sense that we still keep the philosophy that the core components should be isolated in single files. The entire database abstraction layer is about 8,000 lines of code in one single file. The entire template language is about 5,000 lines of code in its own single file. The entire set of web helpers that generate HTML programmatically, that's about 5,000 lines of code, again, in its own single file, and so on. So it's still possible for me to point the students to one file and say, let's rewrite this one file and see what it does. Now, of course, when I rewrite it in class, it's going to be 100 lines of code, not 8,000 lines of code. So mm-hmm. it's not going to have all the details that the actual file contains. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. Let's say we want to implement a database abstraction layer in class. I have to choose one particular SQL dialect, let's say SQLite, and do it for SQLite. WebPy can talk to 10 different database engines, and each of them has its own caveats and exceptions. And that's what makes it very difficult.
Sure. Sure. And so, actually, I was sort of curious. As I was looking over the templating language, you somehow managed to get Python into the middle of a template and not care about indenting. And I didn't think mm-hmm. Python could be parsed without indenting properly.
Well, we just use a trick. Python has a keyword, which is pass, that just means nothing. Doesn't do anything. But I've been using Emacs for a long time, and when Emacs finds the start of a block, and then inside the block there is a pass or there is a return, it understands that the block has ended. So the idea of WebPy is to use the same mechanism. And we start a block with colon, and we end the block with either pass or return. What the template language does it sees that there is Python code into HTML. The first thing it does, it reverses that, and you get HTML into Python code. Then it goes over the Python code and indents it following this rule. So if when it finds a pass, it understands it's the end of a block, and now it knows how to re-indent the code, and then generates basically a piece of Python code which is now correct, is indented correctly, and includes print statements for the HTML that was outside, and that's executed.
Wow. Wow. I learned something new about Python.
This is something that in class I can do like in about 20 lines of code.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I didn't realize there was the equivalent of a closed curly brace in Python. That's really nice. Why they just didn't call it a closed curly brace, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. But okay, that's just my bias.
It's not quite the same. We need to add the spaces. We need to add the indentation. But we have a way to mark up the end of a block. We could have used a comment to do the same thing.
So how much of Web2Py are you also using in terms of your other kinds of classes? Then, like, are you still you're teaching things about economics and stuff?
What I do mostly here at Paul, I teach courses on applications of computer science for numerical applications, so for physics and for finance. Mm-hmm. And I manage the Master of Science in Computational Finance. So I mostly teach courses where I have students learning about financial applications of computer science. So they build option pricers, they build risk management software. And I don't use Web2Py for those, but I use Python a lot.
Okay, so to bring it, I know Randall's asked a little bit about this before, but I was looking through your options for hosting Web2Py projects, and one of the big problems I have with things like Django and so on is getting commodity web hosting with support for things like Python. Is that something that you worry about at all? Do you have any deals with hosts and things? Can people get this hosted easily if they want to make a production kind of version of this?
I would say more or less. The rule is if Django works, Web2Py works, just because we use the same very similar adapters. The one difference that by default, Web2Py uses the file system more. Like if you want to use the administrative interface, that means that the web application needs to write on the file system, needs to be able to edit the files. So this is the only caveat. Every time you run on any virtual private server, it's fine. There's no problem. If you're in a shared hosting environment, then it really depends on the kind of operating system and the kind of Python version they provide. There are a lot of shared hosts out there that only support Python 2.4, and that's a big problem, and only support CGI or ModPython. ModPython is now deprecated. We can run with ModPython, but we don't really recommend that. So if you have a shared host that provides you a WGI connector, then it's fine. We can run there.
Okay, well, that's... Sorry, go on.
No, I just said we provide scripts to set up virtual private servers on different operating systems.
Excellent. I mean, that's a similar thing, as I say, that you get with a lot of frameworks, Django and other things, which, finding kind of certified shared web hosts who will host things like Django for you can be quite difficult. I noticed that you support the Google App Engine, which is very cool. So how did that come about? And can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, we supported the Google App Engine more or less from the beginning. Now there are different ways you can run the Google App Engine. Basically, Google App Engine, until very recently, provided not a SQL database, but a data store. And in order to talk to the data store, you have to use some Google API. So what we did, we took our database abstraction layer, and instead of having the database abstraction layer generate SQL, when it's running on the Google App Engine, it generates function calls. So we had this almost from the beginning, as soon as Google released the Google App Engine, which means that almost any Python, almost any Web2Py program can run on the Google App Engine. There are some caveats, and the caveats are the kind of queries you can make on the Google App Engine are a little different. For example, you cannot do search for text inside the text variable. You cannot do an OR statement that involves different fields. So there are certain differences, which means the way you program with Py when you want to run on the Google App Engine or when you want to run on SQL database may be a little different. So what we try to do, we try to make the database abstraction layer work in both cases and take advantages of the features of the type of database that you have. But it's not always the most efficient solution. Let me give you another example. In the Google Data Store, you have a type of field, which is basically a list of references or a list of integers or a list of strings. So we support that feature. And when you build for the App Engine, you have that feature. Now, if you want to run an SQL database, the database abstraction layer still works, and you can still use that feature, but it's implemented in a completely different way, which is not as efficient as on the Google App Engine. So certain features are more efficient in one platform, certain features are more efficient with another platform, and the developer needs to know, but we try to make it work on both platforms.
Mm. And has there been a good adoption of people deploying stuff on the Google App Engine with Web2Py? Have you seen a lot of people interested in that?
I know a lot of people have been using the Google App Engine. Yes, Web2Py with the Google App Engine. It's one of those tools that basically give you flexibility. Google App Engine is essentially free for low traffic, and a lot of people like to deploy there. Web2Py gives them the choice that if for whatever reason they need to move out of Google App Engine, they don't need to rewrite their code.
Right. Yeah, that sounds really useful. I mean, keeping it portable and all of that kind of thing. And you have an Amazon EC2. Is there an image or something you've got there? I noticed there's some mention of Amazon EC2 on your documentation as well.
At some point I made one. I'm not sure if it's public. We don't distribute an EC2 image. It's just that once you get a virtual private server on EC2 is released, it's not Web2Py anyway.
Hmm. Right, okay. And one of the big kind of things that I hear a lot, and I'm sure everybody who works with Python hear a lot, is the accusation that Python is too slow and all of this kind of stuff. But recently I've been very interested in PyPy, and I was wondering if you've looked at PyPy and any of that stuff. You mentioned that the database is often the bottleneck for you with performance, maybe, you know, which is a common thing across all database-driven web apps. Have you looked at something like PyPy, which, for the benefit of the listener, is Python written in Python, which is actually faster than normal C Python, which is a bit hard to understand at first. But have you looked at PyPy at all?
Yes, I've looked at that. In fact, we had to make a few changes to Web2Py to make it work with PyPy. And users have been doing more testing than I did. My understanding is that right now it works on PyPy.
Excellent. That's very cool, because I think that's something that's going to take off in the future. So how much is of a learning curve is this? If, say, I've got a Rails application, and I think, oh, that might be nice to do in Web2Py. Is there a big learning curve there, and is there any way that I could transfer some of the stuff I've done to Web2Py?
I think if you know an MVC web framework, it's relatively easy to get into Web2Py. Because most of the syntax is different, but many things you translate almost line by line. Like if you know Rails, and the template language of Rails allow you to write Rails code into the views, and in our case, you have to translate that from Ruby into Python. But that's not a big deal. That's relatively easy to do. And also with the idea that each controller is a file, each action is a function, that controller, that's very similar. You have to learn the different API. So how you redirect from one action to another action, we use a keyword redirect. Other frameworks may use a different keyword. So there are a few details of this nature. Probably the only part that you really need to learn, which is different, are the way forms are handled, because we have API that automatically generate forms for you. So that's a little different. And also, the way we handle access control, we have a role-based access control system built in. So it's very granular. You can give you can create users groups, and you can give permissions to members of groups. Can be permission to act, to read, write, or do anything with any object. You can get permission at the individual record for each table, for each record. You can set permissions. So that's something that needs some studying.
So interesting. So actually, you know, all web frameworks ultimately sort of come down to the point where eventually they're spitting out less than and greater than in some varying quantities. So obviously knowing some web framework gives you a bit of a head start on Web2Py. And it's nice to know that a lot of the higher level stuff also passes through. But I want to make a slight change in topic here just for a second, if you don't mind. Given that we don't have much time left, so limiting this to 300 words, what is lattice quantum chromodynamics?
Well, that's what I've been trained for all my life. That's what I've been doing most of my life. It's basically, let me try to explain. There are protons and there are neutrons. Protons and neutrons comprise 99% of the stuff in the universe, and they're made of quarks. So there is a mathematical model that explains how quarks interact with each other to form all kind of complicated forms of matter, from atomic nuclei to stars and all kind of other things. And this mathematical model has been very solid for many years, and many people got the Nobel Prize for it. Mm-hmm. And lattice quantum chromodynamics is a numerical formulation of this mathematical model. So it's a way to do computations with very powerful supercomputers to predict the properties of composite particles from the rules of the game, which are the basic laws of physics. So that's what I've been doing most of my life. Most of the programs I've been writing, and the programs I consider complex programs, are more on that side, more than on the Web2Py side.
No. I got to challenge you here, because I've been learning this stuff recently since I just visited the LHC and Grand Massimo and whatever the thing is, the target for the neutrinos. So not 99, you said protons and neutrons are 99% of the universe. No, 99% of the visible universe.
It's our
dark matter.
There is such thing as dark matter. Yes, well, some people think there is such a thing as dark matter. We'll see.
And the other thing I learned that was sort of interesting, and I'm sure you could probably quote this to me better than Worm, was that I learned just on this past cruise, there was a lot of physicists on there. So the thing that I learned was that the particles travel in a direction, and the interactions travel in directions that minimize the amount of path or energy state they have to change in. I thought that was sort of fascinating, that it just takes sort of the shortest computed path.
The matter is complicated. Let me put it this way. It used to be that we would think of particles as a point-like object that every time has a position in space. So we used to think about paths. Things have changed, and we should think of a particle more or less like a class in a computer program. And the coordinates of the particle are not attributes of the class or of the object. They are more like methods that may return a value when we call them. But if I call the method twice, I don't always get the same number. What does it mean in practice? In practice, it means that in physics, we don't describe the paths of the objects. We describe the correlation between events. So what's the probability that I shoot a particle in one way and I find a particle in another place later in time? So there is not one path that the particle takes in going from point A to B, unless I look for the path. If I look for the path, then there is one because I looked for it. I call the methods of the object, so I know that they have a value. But if I don't call those methods, there's not such a thing as one path. So the way we think of it is the particle going from A to B takes all possible paths, and each path is weighted with certain value. And the probability of the particle going from A to B is the weighted average of all possible paths. This is what we call quantum mechanics. And that's what everybody does today.
Wow, this is great. I can't imagine a better overlap between computer science and high energy physics. This is really, really amazing. One more thing, though. I know you were at Fermi for a while, right? And Fermi recently shut down, closed. How does it affect you? How do you feel about that?
Well, from one point of view, it's sad that the main experiment shut down, but it's not a surprise. It's just that this kind of experiments, this particle accelerators, cost of the order of $10 billion. And they have a life. They have a life which is based on how powerful they are and what kind of things they can look at. So right now, the most powerful one is the one in Geneva, in Switzerland. So there is really no reason to run the Formula One as it is unless there were major upgrades to be made. And the government had no funding for those upgrades, unfortunately. But the laboratory is still there. There are many experiments they're still doing, which are really important, in particular experiments that have to do with neutrinos. And also there is a fantastic theory group, and there are many people I know there, and also a lot of groups that do research in computing. They analyze the data that comes from Geneva, so the data is copied back here in the U.S. and analyzed by physicists in the U.S. So the laboratory is very much still there, just one experiment being decommissioned.
Yeah, I know the Fermi guys are really looking hard at the neutrinos faster than light issue that came out recently. So,
what's your thought on that?
Yes. Anyway, shifting back slightly to the normal topic of this show, what license is WebDPI under?
WebDPI is LGPL3.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what's the future? Give us the short view of where you think WebDPI is going to go.
That's a good question. I don't know. Certainly, there would be a Web3 Pi that runs on Python 3 and has different features, even if some core design would be very similar. What I really would like to work more is make web development even easier. I envision that people should do web development without even typing code, but just dragging objects in the screen. And WebDPI was originally designed to make it easy and was supposed to be always backward compatible because it was supposed to be the foundation on which to build something better. And we're trying to build something better, something that uses WebDPI underneath but allow you to do visual development and perhaps even on your mobile. You're on your mobile phone and you press buttons and you end up with a web application. So that's not been done yet, but I'm working on it.
Are you looking for certain kinds of resources for that? I mean, we have a pretty good audience here. Is there anything like you're looking for, a stronger Perl or stronger Python programmers or, darn it, or people are good at CSS or jQuery or anything? I mean, are you missing resources? And if so, what would those be like?
I don't think I'm missing resources. So we have a lot of really good good programmers in the WebDPI community. It's more like we need to design it well. And that requires a lot of conversations to people. So we are having these kind of conversations within the WebDPI community, like which kind of tools should we build, which kind of components should we build. But that takes time.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, I think we covered a lot of stuff, including some high-energy physics. So is there anything I left out of the conversation you want to make sure our audience knows about?
Well, I just wanted to say hello to all your audience. And I also wanted to take the opportunity to thank the other WebDPI developers. I mean, there is many of them. There is no way I can thank them all, but I can certainly think of some people who have been really putting a lot of time into this, like Jonathan Lundell or Mariano Reingart or Bruno Rocca or Martin Moulon or Michele Comitini or Iceberg. There are a lot of people. I apologize, I cannot mention everybody, but these people have really done an excellent job, and WebDPI would not be what it is today if these people had not put a lot of their time in it.
Very good. Well, I know that every large open source project has a lot of contributors to it, and I'm sure they appreciate being mentioned specifically here. And to all who don't get mentioned, it's not that bias. It's just just too many, not enough time in the class. Yes, class. What I say class for? What am I getting schooled? Well, Massimo, I'm really happy you came on the show and talked about Web2Pi. I'm sure a lot of people are now going to be perking up a little bit and seeing what kind of interest this will generate. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you again for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be there.
You're most welcome. Thanks a lot. That was Massimo Di Piero, who is an associate professor at the School of Computing of DePaul University in Chicago, and also the originator and chief designer of Web2Pi. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I think it was really, really interesting. And I didn't mean to over-egg the, you know, this thing about there being a controversy over the design. I couldn't think of a better word than controversy. I hope that wasn't too strong. But it's very different to other frameworks, as he's saying, because they do seem to take that kind of role of trying to make things simpler and deciding for the user what's best in a lot of cases. And as we know, in computer science and in many fields, people have different opinions on which is the best approach to take, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I really like that too. And I also like the idea that he's trying to get a web framework that you can do entirely from the browser. You know, we have that with one of the variants of Seaside and also with called Web Velocity. I should give that name in there. And also with Cappuccino, we had them on the show a couple of years ago, which was basically using essentially Xcode kind of interfaces Objective-J. So this whole idea of web programming, though, about getting something that really looks like an application up on the screen, I'm sure some parts of Tim Berners-Lee occasionally, you know, if he was dead, would be rolling over in his grave about it, because he sort of saw it instead of just a hypertext link set of documents that had some interactivity. But, you know, we do have modern browsers that really have an amazing amount of graphics capabilities, even more so with HTML5 and Canvas and those kinds of things coming up. And so there's really probably almost a gold rush now to try to figure out what's the magic sauce there. What's the secret sauce to be able to make web applications that look more like desktop applications, once again, swing back and forth. Any other comments on that?
No, I think you're definitely right there. I mean, for a long time, it's kind of like been this thing that's been on the horizon for a very long time, that web applications have been edging towards becoming more like desktop applications. You've got Google doing stuff like Google Gears. That's what, you know, so you can do things like Gmail offline and then just sync it up and all that kind of thing. I think that's only going to keep, as you say, keep growing. And it is a bit of a gold rush. I guess we'll see who wins out in the end.
Yeah, especially like this new Google Dart language. I hope to get these guys on the air sometime soon. Dart seems like a really fascinating thing where you have a much more like super rich JavaScript-ish plus kind of environment, but that it can still be compiled down to JavaScript, which is sort of bizarre. So we'll get Dart on the show sometime soon. I know I've gotten the request from a bunch of people already. So we'll get them on, because actually Gilad Scala or Gilad Braca was actually a guest on our show about a year ago. So we'll just bring him back on and have him talk about something entirely new. Speaking of people coming on the show, we have just about filled out our Q4 schedule. We've got a lot of people still left on the list for Q4, though, coming up next week. A good friend of mine now, Jeffrey Thalhammer, going to talk about Perl Critic, which is the lint for Perl. If you're used to lint for C or C++, you'll know that it basically points out places where you've probably gone wrong. Perl Critic is doing that for Perl, much more so than just use warnings does on that. That should be a really good show. He's a good speaker. I got to see him in a presentation here in LA about 9 months ago. I had to have him on the show as a result. Antonio Scuri is going to talk to us from Brazil, I believe, about a universal interface kind of thing. He did the Lua version of it. So we'll ask him a lot about Lua as well. We've got Thomas Hatch coming up after that, talking about Salt. Salt is a distributed framework for making tasks multiply across many, many different machines. So if you have something that requires, say, 20 machines to process, like maybe you've got a bunch of EC2 machines or whatever, this sort of acts as the broker in between to distribute all that and gather all the results back up. It uses something called ZeroMQ inside of it. And I want to get the ZeroMQ guys on as well, because it looks like a pretty interesting project. Coming up after that, James Talbert. Pinax, I don't know how you pronounce that, P-I-N-A-X, and he's going to be talking to us. That actually is a Django-based web framework, so it's about 5 weeks away. Don't worry, we're not putting web frameworks next to each other like we did a couple times last year. And then, I tell you, this was a score. Finally, after 2 years of pestering, Monty Wydenius and Kurt von Fink are going to come to us and talk to us about MySQL and MariaDB. Yes, this is the big show you guys have all been asking for, all been looking for. Probably the number one most used commercial database in the world, besides SQLite. Sorry, I just got to fix that. So they're going to be coming on, talking to us sometime early December. David Mirza, the Vega security tester, coming after that. That's the sort of a web penetration testing framework. It looks really, really cool. And then Sieber Rosa, or is that clever? Sieber Rosa
about AutoTest, which is a testing framework for building things, especially real-time stuff like for the Linux kernel. A lot more people on this short list. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you can see our mailing list, or not our mailing list, the upcoming spreadsheet of all the people we're going to have on future shows. If you have a project that is not on that list, please email the project leader. Not me. Email the project leader and tell them, I really love Floss Weekly, and you guys should be on it because you're with good company. So please, I'm very happy. Just have them email me at MerlinStonehenge.com. You can also email to floss@twit.tv. That will get to me as well in case you don't want to remember all the letters of Merlin or Stonehenge. Speaking of that, as we add more people to the list, I'll probably start my Q1 booking in a couple of weeks. As we start adding more people, if you follow the Floss Weekly Twitter handle or Identica handle, you will see the guests as we book them on. Also, reminders of who's coming up this week. You can also follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter and Identica, although I don't really post to my Identica handle at all. But anyway, follow me on Twitter, and then you find out where I am, all the cool places I get to hang out. Most of the time I'm in Los Angeles these days. Like tonight I'll be at the Los Angeles Pearlmongers meeting, but I'm in other meetups in the L.A. area. I'm actually trying to go to maybe 3 different meetups a week here in L.A. because I have no other friends, so I might as well hang out in social groups that meet about technical stuff. And again, this is probably one of the last few weeks you'll see me without a beard because I'm going to grow a beard starting in a few weeks. I turned 50. Oh my God, get out the walker. And I don't have any cruises until January though. So actually I'll have probably a full beard on my first cruise coming up soon. One more thing that I want to plug is that, my good friend, Stephen Ewan Cobb, who runs the podcast, The Future and You, I've been on his podcast 5 or 6 times, and just recently I ran across a news article that talked about a remote insulin pump attack. These guys, idiots, have a Wi-Fi enabled this embedded device that pumps insulin in your bloodstream. They Wi-Fi enabled it, and they found an attack for it. So this is called it's funny because the attack says remote denial of service, and they mean threat to life. That's the ultimate denial of service, I guess. Is you're offline. End of line, man. So anyway, so I mentioned this to Stephen because that's actually a kind of a favorite of mine. It's a topic of mine, which is risks in employing technology in ways that, you know, what could possibly go wrong kind of stuff. And usually what could possibly go wrong actually does. I mean, we saw some of this with Y2K. We saw some of this with just things like this. What were they thinking? Wi-Fi enabled insulin pumps? It doesn't make any sense. Speaking of Wi-Fi enabled insulin pumps, Dan, what's coming up for you?
That sounds a bit like a band name, doesn't it? I think everything sounds like a band name, but yes. I'll have to start a band called Wi-Fi enabled insulin pumps. Just quickly, related to what you were saying there about, this medical applications and so on. Good friend of mine, Karen Sandler, who's now the executive director of the Noam Foundation. She did a great talk at OzCon she has a heart condition and she has a device in her heart and the battle that she went through to get access to the source code that runs on the device in her body. So that's really interesting. Have a look on Google for that one. If you search for Karen Sandler, OzCon, you'll get a really great video of that. But it's only a few minutes as well. It's well worth watching. But anyway, onto my own kind of plugs, I suppose. Don't forget to check out Linux Outlaws. I've got the t-shirt on this week. And that's live every Monday night in Europe. Well, obviously there are time differences. It's 7 p.m. in Europe, so you'll have to work that out for your own time zone, I'm afraid. But the podcasts are always available. And we have lots of news from the open source world, discussions, guests, all that kind of stuff. Lots of listener feedback as well. So if you head to sixgun.org/Linux Outlaws or just search for Linux Outlaws, you'll come up with that. And also, don't forget to have a look at Rat Hole Radio, which is a music show that I do as well. And you can find all of the information about all the stuff I do at danlynch.org, along with links to Twitter, Identica, Google+, Facebook, all those kind of things. So don't forget to come and look me up on there.
Absolutely. Definitely check out Linux Outlaws, my favorite news show for the open source community. I appreciate that you guys do all that hard work. And it just the show keeps getting longer and longer, though. So is there any way like, you could keep it down to like 2 hours, maybe?
It is getting longer. We've got a memory leak somewhere.
Time to reboot. Well, Dan, as always, thank you for sitting in the co-host spot this week. I know you've had your chance at both sides of the equation recently, and I appreciate you coming on the show when you can take time out of your busy schedule. And of course, I hear the music coming out in the background. You know what that means? It's just about over. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.